and welcome to the Science Podcast for July 25th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the way forward for an HIV vaccine after the failed STEP trial. Following the money spent on HIV/AIDS research and treatment, sounds from Acoustics 08 in Paris, how the first congressional earmarks for funding science centers have stood the test of time, and we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
According to the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS, an estimated 2.1 million people died of AIDS-related causes in 2007. Another 2.5 million became infected, meaning the total number of people worldwide living with HIV in 2007 is estimated to be about 33.2 million people. While the pandemic has been somewhat curtailed in some countries through prevention and treatment, researchers have been working toward a vaccine to provide immunity. But recent hopes for a vaccine were dashed when results from the STEP study last fall suggested that people who got the trial vaccine were more susceptible to HIV infection than those who had not. In a perspective in this week's Science, Anthony Fauci and colleagues discuss the way forward for HIV vaccine research. Fauci is director of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and spoke with Science's deputy editor Barbara Jasny.
What, if anything, was learned from the trial?
Well, there were several things that were learned from the STEP trial. Many of them were things that could be looked upon as a negative. Then what I'm referring to specifically was that it's clear that one of the two non-human primate animal models that were used as surrogates for decision-making in the human situation is not really a good model for T-cell vaccines. From now on, this model should probably only be used if you're looking at fundamentally an antibody vaccine as opposed to a T-cell vaccine. The other thing is that we learned that the immunological markers that we were using as surrogates, in fact, again, can be a little bit, I wouldn't say misleading, but are not as potent indicators of what is going on in the world of real protection. So a lot was learned. Unfortunately, they were things that were telling us that we were maybe on the wrong track a bit for certain surrogates and other models that we were using.
Anything about the vector itself?
Yes. There was also something that has to do with safety. We don't know the mechanism of why the vaccinated people who had an underlying immunity as measured by neutralizing antibodies to the vector in this case was adenovirus 5, we found that in people with a higher titer of antibody against adeno, which reflected a prior exposure, who happened also to be uncircumcised, that the risk of getting infected upon exposure seemed to be greater in the vaccinated group than in the unvaccinated group. That tells us a couple of things. It tells us clearly that immunity to the vector is important. We don't know the mechanisms of why we saw this surprising and somewhat disconcerting result about possible increased risk. But it does give us a big red flag that when you vaccinate and you use a vector to which someone has a prior immunity, it is likely that there is a degree of activation against the vector, which might, and again I say might because we don't know the precise mechanisms, that might actually create a state of activation that allows cells to be more permissive for being infected with HIV. So now whenever you have a vaccine trial in which a vector is used, we're going to scrutinize that very, very carefully.
The NIAID held a summit this past March to look for ways to reinvigorate HIV vaccine research. The general opinion seemed to be that there has been too much emphasis on product evaluation and not enough on basic research. How will that approach be changed and how will it be funded?
Well, right now there's no doubt that even though we are in an arena of fiscal constraint, that we will be turning the knob, as I like to say, more preferentially towards answering some of the fundamental questions that have gone unanswered. Paramount among these is to determine why it is so difficult in the natural state to induce broadly neutralizing antibodies, and why are they so uncommon in the natural infection? Also, what do we need to do from an immunogen standpoint to elicit these broadly neutralizing antibodies? A lot of vaccinology has been successfully empirical in other situations with other microbes and other viruses, mostly because we knew as a baseline that the body had the machinery to successfully develop an immune response upon natural challenge, and we would empirically try and mimic that natural exposure with our vaccine product. So empiricism was not only successful, it was one of the things that we went to relatively early in the process. There still will have to be some degree of what might be construed as empiricism, but we need to answer some fundamental questions, namely the bar for going ahead with an empiric trial of a product is going to be much higher now than it was until we develop the capability of understanding the process so we can guide the development of our vaccines based on more fundamental, basic understanding of the concepts. And then we're going to reevaluate the cost and the whole structure of the clinical trial process to determine is if that process is not fully being utilized because of the lack of candidates to test, that everything is on the table to look at perhaps re-emphasizing the resource distribution.
Do you envision any funds being redirected?
I think that that is a distinct possibility, and that's why I use the terminology that really everything is on the table. We're going to look at our entire portfolio and re-examine it. So it is entirely conceivable that we will be redirecting resources.
In your policy forum, you mentioned the need for new ideas. Where will these new ideas come from?
Well, I think the new ideas will spring from the now heightened emphasis on basic and fundamental discovery. Also, new ideas come from people who come into the field fresh, and they're not tainted, if I might use that word, not necessarily in a totally negative way, but they're not predetermined in their thought processes by being involved with the problem for such a long period of time. So the beauty of de novo fundamental discoveries coupled with new blood, new talent, people with new ideas, I think are going to put us in very good stead for the future.
That was lead author Anthony Fauci talking with Science's deputy editor Barbara Jasny about the next steps for HIV vaccine research. You can read the perspective as well as a related perspective on microbicides in a special section on HIV/AIDS in this week's Science. Also in this week's HIV/AIDS special section, Following the Money, contributing correspondent John Cohen examines how funding for HIV/AIDS in low- and middle-income countries has grown from a few hundred million U.S. dollars in the 1980s to $10 billion last year. In the magazine's cover story, Cohen writes on where that money has gone, the results it has produced, and whether resources can keep up with future demands.
The funding that's come to AIDS over the past decade has been such a phenomenal jump from about $450 million in aid to low- and middle-income countries to $10 billion, that it deserves scrutiny. And this package of stories tries to look closely at what has happened to all that money, why did it come flooding out, will it continue, and will it be able to keep up with the virus? Then on top of that, there's a research component because the research funding has also skyrocketed in that same time period. So the package tries to look at where some of that money has gone.
What have been the major milestones in HIV/AIDS funding since 1984 when scientists showed that HIV caused AIDS?
The big challenge from the time that scientists first showed that HIV causes AIDS was to develop a way to help people who were infected, and failures mounted up at an incredible rate between 1984 and 1994. And then there was a breakthrough in 94 because researchers showed for the first time that even a mediocre HIV drug could stop transmission from an infected woman to her baby if she was pregnant. And that was a remarkable achievement. It was the first time that drugs really did something in a powerful way that said, hey, these things work. And then the next year, researchers developed a new class of drugs that when combined with the existing drugs really worked in infected people. For the first time, you could really see that, hey, these drugs knock the virus down far enough to allow people to live a very long time. And that's been the status quo now for 13 years. The problem was is that these drugs were incredibly expensive. They cost about $15,000 a year for a cocktail of these drugs for each person. And most infected people in the world live in poor countries and are poor themselves. There was no way they could afford these medications. And that inequity, that drugs existed that worked but were not available to the majority of people who needed them, led to this essentially a revolution where people went to the streets, people turned conferences upside down and said, this isn't right, it's not fair, it can't go on this way. And in 2000, the International AIDS Conference was held in Durban, South Africa, and everything really came to a head there, in part because of where the conference was located, at the epicenter of the epidemic, the country that had more infected people than anywhere else. And after that week, I think it became clear to the world that this was no longer business as usual. And several new financing mechanisms soon came about that led to this flood of money.
As things are now, then, will there be universal access to treatment by 2010, as declared by the United Nations General Assembly?
Everyone I interviewed for this package of stories who has thought about the issue says no. And even UNAIDS has officially said that this isn't likely. There's simply not enough money in the coffers to reach that goal, and it's not even clear that there's enough capacity on the ground to do it. It requires a huge number of trained people to deliver anti-HIV drugs to an entire country. And many countries have shortages of doctors and nurses. Many countries have really poor infrastructure and don't have the ability to even get the drugs out on time, and they need help bolstering those things, and all of that takes time. And one of the things that I look at in the package is Botswana, because it was the first country to offer free treatment to all of its citizens in need. And Botswana struggled. It took a lot longer than Botswana, a very well-to-do country, relatively speaking, a very well-organized country, very low corruption. It took it a long time to get the program up to speed.
What about money for prevention and education? Is that money getting to where it's needed most?
I think that's one of the main points of this package, is that prevention has, in a sense, suffered because of all the attention put toward treatment. And most everywhere realizes now that unless they make more headway in preventing new infections, there's just no way to afford a continuing program that offers free treatment to every infected person. Even in the countries that have made great progress, like Botswana, they realize that their program can't be sustained.
Now, you mentioned research earlier. How do the attempts into making an HIV vaccine or microbicides designed to prevent transmission fit into this HIV/AIDS funding story?
Both HIV vaccines and microbicides that aim to stop HIV have failed miserably time and time and again in real-world studies. And the research communities in those arenas, I think, are pretty much in the same place that the drug research community was at in 1993, which was the doom and gloom year. Like, everybody's hearts had been broken so many times. Expectations had been raised and crushed so many times that there was a sort of level of exhaustion that even set in, and this cry to let's go back to basics. I think the push right now for vaccine research is to simply address the most riddling of all questions, which is researchers really don't understand what immune response protects people from HIV.
Is it further research in vaccines and microbicides that is being funded by the current research part of the pie, or is that money going into something else now?
Yeah, well, the research portfolios for both vaccines and microbicides are divided between staging clinical studies in humans and doing fundamental research. The NIH budget is divided basically into four big pie, slices of pie. Vaccines are one of those slices. Drugs and therapies are another one. And then training and infrastructure is the third one. And then everything else is more epidemiology and behavioral science and pathogenesis, more some fundamental things. Microbicides are only about 3% of the budget, so they're not a huge part of the budget. But vaccines are. And so the fight within each of these communities is always, how much money do you put into basic fundamental research that isn't necessarily geared toward developing a product, and how much do you put into product development and testing? And that's always been the struggle in these fields, because people differ greatly in their opinions based on what type of work they do.
In this extensive feature following HIV/AIDS funding, you examined disparities, which programs were doing the most good with their limited funds, examples of corruption, examples of treatment being preferred over prevention, and funding for research. Is there honest hope out there among leaders and scientists that we'll soon have a better handle on HIV/AIDS?
HIV is just not easy to stop, and the reason it's not easy to stop is because human behavior isn't easy to change. And it's like asking the United States to lose weight, let's say, as a country. Okay, everybody, let's lose weight. Well, you can have that as a goal, but it's just not easy to make those societal changes occur. Yes, we do have ways to stop transmission of HIV, and yes, an individual's behavior often is the determining factor. Not always. I mean, a baby doesn't do anything. Somebody who's raped doesn't make a decision that made that happen. But, you know, for the most part, people can make decisions that can prevent or protect themselves from becoming infected. But it's not simply a matter of educating people about risk. And it's just one of the diciest things about human nature is how do you make people behave on their risk knowledge? And there's just no easy answer for that. Is there hope? Sure, there's hope. There are more effective ways to lead to behavior change than others. But right now, there's a dearth of scientific information about which interventions work best. And then there's also hope with biomedical interventions. I am certain that some of these are going to work, and it's a question of when. Nobody can answer the question with certainty, but I think in the next few years, we're going to see some advances in biomedical approaches to preventing HIV spread.
John Cohen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Contributing correspondent John Cohen follows the money spent on HIV/AIDS in a package of articles in this week's Science.
This is Nancy Goff, editor of Science Signaling. We are now accepting original research submissions for publication starting September 2008. The journal formerly known as Science's SDKE is devoted to the topic of cellular signal transduction. To learn more, go to www.sciencesignaling.org.
The science of acoustics merges many disciplines, including architecture, speech science, oceanography, physics, medicine, and, of course, music. Earlier this month, scientists gathered in Paris for Acoustics 08, the largest meeting ever devoted to the science of acoustics. Contributing correspondent John Bohannon was there. Here's an excerpt from his report of the conference.
If you ever run into a tiger, this is what you want to hear. That's the sound of a happy tiger. Tigers don't purr like house cats, so they make this sound with their nostrils instead. It's called prusten, from the German word for snorting. Here's what you don't want to hear. That's a territorial moan, telling other tigers and you to keep your distance. These sounds are part of a study of tiger vocalizations at the Henry Doorly Zoo in Omaha, Nebraska. It was presented at Acoustics 08, a conference that took place in Paris earlier this month. A team led by Edward Walsh, an acoustic physiologist at Boys Town National Research Hospital, analyzed the frequency spectrum of these vocalizations, like the sound of this unhappy tiger cub. When they anesthetized tigers and played a range of sounds, they measured brain activation. The results show that tigers are able to produce and perceive sounds in the infrasound range, lower in frequency than most animals can hear. For example, here's a confrontational roar. Packed into that roar is an infrasonic component that humans can't hear. This study is one of the very first hearing tests of large carnivores. Researchers at the conference also presented the first hearing test of polar bears. That's the threatening grumble and snort of a 1,000-pound bear. Instead of anesthetizing this animal, like the tigers, a team led by Ann Bowles at the HUBC World Research Institute in San Diego, California, trained polar bears to respond to sounds played through speakers. Now, the results of that hearing test show that polar bears may have excellent hearing, but they are only sensitive to sounds within frequencies between 125 hertz and 20,000 hertz. That's similar to humans, and not quite as broad a range as smaller carnivorous animals. Knowing what endangered animals such as tigers and polar bears can and cannot hear will help conservation biologists protect them from noise pollution.
You can read Bohannon's full coverage of the conference in the July 18th issue of Science, as well as hear other sounds from the conference in the online version of the article at www.sciencemag.org. Most scientists deplore the practice of politicians setting aside money in so-called earmarks for special science projects, arguing that it undermines the established peer review process used to judge a project's merit. But as Deputy News Editor Jeffrey Mervis reports in this week's Science, the first two earmarks in the U.S. for academic research created science centers that have stood the test of time, one at Tufts University in Massachusetts and one at Catholic University in Washington, D.C.
This is an article about what's happened to two projects that were funded by Congress under a mechanism that's known as earmarks. This is when a legislator in his or her district decides that a project should receive money that has not been requested by that agency or has not gone through a review by the appropriate congressional committees. It's also called pork barrel projects.
The less appealing term of pork barrel projects suggests that these projects are not well regarded. How do the scientists that you spoke with for this article view them?
Scientists almost unanimously disapprove of them. They feel that it undermines the peer review process and that if a university wants to build a facility or conduct a certain type of research, it should go through the normal peer review process. The problem is that there's never enough money for all the things that scientists want to do. So back in the late 70s, a couple universities decided to go directly to Congress to request money, in this case for buildings that they wanted on their campus in order for their scientists to be able to pursue the research that they thought was necessary.
At the time, in the 70s when it started, how much was set aside for these universities and what did it help them do?
Well, this was a new phenomenon, so they were starting from zero. And what happened in the case of Tufts University and their then-president, Joe Meyer, was he requested and eventually received $32 million to build a building that would house what became the Human Nutrition Research Center on Aging. It was funded through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. A few years later, the president of Catholic University of America decided to go a similar route to get support for a building that would house his physics department and the Vitreous State Laboratory, which did research on disposing of nuclear waste. That was a total of $14 million. So from small seeds, large trees grow.
And have they indeed grown well, these two programs?
Well, these programs have both carved out an important niche in their fields. They're quite different. One deals with the effects of nutrition on an adult and aging population. The other deals with ways to vitrify or enclose in glass nuclear waste that has been accumulated at both civilian and military nuclear reactors. And what we learned in the course of the article was that the scientific track record of both these centers is very strong. They have managed to get peer-reviewed funding from the appropriate agencies over the last 25 years and maintain their program based on that kind of funding. But the earmark gave them the initial impetus that they needed to have a critical mass and a place in which to do the work.
So these programs at these institutions would not have gotten started, perhaps, without this type of earmarking.
That's right. I think in both cases, the directors admit that their university wasn't willing to put the money in on its own, and the federal agency, for whatever reason, didn't have a program that could fund bricks and mortar. And so their presidents decided that an earmark was the only way to go.
One-time earmark, so it's not ongoing funding?
The one for Catholic University is, and that's typical. The one for Tufts is a little different because it continues to get about $12 million a year from the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, in what amounts to support for basic operations. And the scientists at the Tufts Center say that this is also important because the kind of long-term research that you need to do on nutrition, the kinds of longitudinal studies, are often not popular enough to get funding from NIH, although these scientists do receive NIH funding for specific research proposals.
and the Vitreous Center at Catholic University.
Yes, the Catholic Centers became a leader in the 80s and 90s in this process, which is being used now to build a multi-billion dollar waste treatment facility at Hanford in Washington State, which is the site of the largest amount of low and high-level nuclear waste.
After these two programs got this money, how did the other universities approach this new funding source?
Well, this did open the door, and a lot of universities walked through it. And that's why the amount of earmarks for research and scientific projects has grown so much. The then president of the Association of American Universities, known as AAU, mounted a very vigorous campaign against the practice, arguing that it undermined the peer review process and that with a limited amount of federal funds, they should go to the highest use. All the other universities that had not requested earmarks signed on to it, not surprisingly. But over the years, university presidents haven't been able to resist the opportunity when it arises to get money through the earmark process.
Nowadays, how much funding in the U.S. is through this congressional earmarking process?
A recent calculation by AAAS for the 2008 budget pegged the number at $4.5 billion for research.
So is this kind of funding here to stay then?
I think we can be confident that it is, but I think the debate is also here to stay because it's something that so many scientists feel is not right, but yet there is a pressing need for funding, and funding will usually find a way.
How do the current presidential candidates view this?
John McCain has made reducing or eliminating earmarks one of the pillars of his campaign. It's a popular issue when couched in terms of government waste. Barack Obama, on the other hand, has supported what a lot of people call the need for greater transparency, which is if a legislator is going to ask for an earmark, let's be upfront about it, say who's asking for the money, what is it going to go for, and why is it necessary. The Democrats have tried to reform the process, but I think it's safe to say that it's not in any danger of going away.
Jeffrey Mervis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science's deputy news editor Jeffrey Mervis writes about the history of the first two earmarks for scientific research. Read his article in this week's Science. Now, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about why the U.S. military is no match for Caribbean coral, why some animals need more sleep than others in the wild, and finally, we're going to decode the secret behind white horses.
Well, let's start with how the military isn't any match for Caribbean coral. Has there been an active campaign against Caribbean coral?
Well, in a way, yes. Rob, this story has to do with the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. And this island had been used as a testing ground by the U.S. Navy for nearly 60 years. Bomber pilots, naval gunners, and even assault troops stormed the island, blasting tons of explosives all over the place, and especially in the waters. So biologists had figured that these reefs had pretty much been decimated by all this military activity. But when a group of researchers actually did a comprehensive survey of the reefs off this island and compared it to nearby Caribbean islands, such as the island of St. Croix, what they found was not only were these reefs not decimated, but they were in as good, if not better, shape than reefs in nearby islands that were protected.
Do scientists have some explanation as to how this occurred?
Well, clearly, the reefs did endure some damage. There were places where the reef was completely pulverized by explosions. But what actually may have helped protect the reefs is not that they had some super ability to resist military bombardment, is that the fact that a few years ago, the military actually closed off this island.
So there wasn't ongoing damage like there might have been at these other islands.
Well, it's not so much that as the fact that when the Navy closed off the island during the bombing, there wasn't any tourist development or development of any kind happening on the island. And what's more, when the Navy stopped bombing in 2003, they designated the entire island and the reef system a wildlife refuge, so there couldn't be any development since 2003. And when you compare that to nearby islands where there has been tourist development and this causes all sorts of problems like runoff that goes into the water and can pollute the water and obviously damaged the coral, you didn't have that problem. Even though you had all the bombings on Vieques, you didn't have all this runoff problem. And the researchers say the real surprising conclusion is it turns out this runoff and all these other side effects of tourist development may actually be more damaging than 60 years of naval bombardment.
Sounds like there may be some strategy then for how to rebuild the corals in the Caribbean.
It is hopeful, but at least one expert says that this study may be painting too bright a picture. He says nobody really knows what the long-term impact of all this bombing is. And he does note that the researchers did point out that some of this reef was completely pulverized by the bombing. So clearly, bombing itself isn't good for the reefs. But this idea that if you close off an island to development, that you can protect the reefs, I think should be important to conservationists who are thinking about how to protect coral reefs in the Caribbean and elsewhere.
Well, from shutting down an island and allowing corals to rest, to why some animals can rest more in the wild. I presume some of it has to do with whether they're sleeping above or below ground.
Right, and actually that's part of the answer. But it's a really complicated question. This is an issue that biologists have been grappling with for literally decades. Some animals, like donkeys, only sleep about 3 hours a day, whereas you have animals like bats or armadillos that sleep 20 hours at a time. And why is there such difference in the wild between how much they get? And researchers have proposed a whole slew of explanations. But it's really hard to test all these theories. When people try to test these theories, they often bring animals back to the laboratory, and that's not a real natural setting. So it's hard to say what exactly is happening.
So in the wild, then, what exactly is happening?
Well, what's new about this study is the researchers actually did focus on wild animals. In fact, they spent 2 years combing through tons of data on sleep patterns for 150 mammals, and they narrowed it down to about 60 that there was a real comprehensive data set for. And then using, you know, various statistical analyses, they narrowed this sleep question down to two factors, food and fear. And the food factor goes like this. Animals sleep less if they need to spend a lot of time grazing, as you might expect with, say, herds of horses. If they're spending their whole day and night grazing, they don't have a lot of time for sleep. And the fear factor goes to this idea that if you live in a location that's very sensitive to predation, say, living on the ground versus living in trees, you're going to spend less time sleeping because you're worried about getting eaten. And these two things sound very intuitive, but until now it was hard to show it. But one surprising finding did pop out, and that was that social animals, animals that sleep in groups, tend to sleep a lot less than non-social animals. And that's sort of the opposite of what you expect, because if animals live in groups, you would expect that they would be protecting each other and maybe watching over each other, and they would be able to sleep a lot more. But social animals also tend to be animals that spend a lot of their days grazing. And so, again, these animals are spending a lot of their day doing foraging activities and therefore don't have as much time for sleep.
I suppose the only way then to get more information would be to actually hook up sleep monitors on free-ranging animals?
Well, that's one way. But of course, again, you have the problem of disrupting an animal in its natural environment. So these types of studies are very tricky to do. And this is probably the best we can do as of now.
Well, from understanding why it is that some animals get to sleep more than others to understanding the coloration of particular horses, humans have probably had some impact in preserving certain colors of horses over the centuries. No?
Yeah, they have, Rob. And white horses especially have been very prized. Think of the horses of the Arabian Nights or even the Lone Ranger's Silver. These white or gray horses, as they're officially known, have been with us for quite a while. But researchers don't know what makes these gray horses gray.
Why is it important to know?
Well, beyond it just being a curiosity, how did these gray horses get gray in the first place, is the fact that gray horses actually tend to have a much shorter lifespan than their darker counterparts. They tend to get cancer at around age 15 and can die soon after. And the original thought before this paper came out was that this had something to do with human cancers as well.
So what did this paper examine exactly?
Well, before the study was conducted, the researchers hypothesized that if there was a so-called gray horse gene, that it was dominant, meaning that horses only had to inherit one copy of it to become gray. They also knew about where this gene might lie if it existed, but they didn't know what the gene was. And so a team of researchers looked at about 700 gray horses and about 130 non-gray horses. And they compared the genetic sequence on the specific region of chromosome 25. And what they found was that in a gene called STX17, which as of yet has no known function, there was a duplication of about 4,600 base pairs. And all of the gray horses had this duplication, And none of the non-gray horses had this duplication. So the researchers said, aha, this must be the genetic change that causes gray horses to be gray. And what's also interesting about this duplication is that because the same duplication was present in all of the gray horses the researchers looked at, that means all these gray horses share a common ancestor.
How did they disprove the human cancer connection?
Well, what they did was they looked at tumors from gray horses, and they found that the expression of this STX17 gene was much higher in these tumors than it was in normal gray horse cells. And so not only does part of this gene appear important for the coloring of the horse, it also appears to play a role in cancer, specifically melanoma. And melanoma is an overproduction of cells called melanocytes.
Skin cancer.
Exactly. Skin cancer. And so you can imagine if you have a duplication of a gene, maybe you're expressing a lot more of it, which is causing more of these cells to form potentially, which may be leading to the cancer. But the mechanism is still unknown. But what's interesting is what you have is the same genetic change that is causing the horses to have this gray color also seems to be predisposing them to cancer.
But that's not the same mechanism that leads to human cancers?
Right, because human melanomas have a different gene expression pattern. So whereas some studies have tried to glean information about what's happening in human melanoma from horses, because horses also get it, this study says that they're really not directly comparable because horses may be getting melanoma for a completely different reason than humans do.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking to stories about the unrealized power of parasites, how monkeys tell each other to watch out, and finally, we're delving into the mysteries of the Northern Lights. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is the letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we start with a letter in response to a May 16th News of the Week story by David Grimm about a global strategy for dealing with alcohol abuse. In that article, Grimm writes about the World Health Organization's steps to curb the harms associated with alcohol abuse.
In the July 4th issue, Victor Rogley from Duke University Medical Center writes that he was dismayed, but not surprised, to learn that several countries, including the United States, insisted that the Director General of the WHO include the alcohol industry in discussions to shape global strategy concerning alcohol abuse.
The alcohol industry, Rogley writes, is equivalent to the vector for alcohol-induced disease. Inviting this industry to the discussion table regarding attempts to curb alcohol-related deaths is analogous to inviting the mosquito to participate in discussion concerning the control of malaria.
You can read the full letter in the July 4th issue. Also from that issue, a letter about painful publishing from Martin Raff at University College London and colleagues at the University of California, San Diego and Howard Hughes Medical Institute.
Raff and colleagues write, "The stress associated with publishing experimental results, a process that can take as long as obtaining the results in the first place, can drain much of the joy from practicing science. What can be done to speed up the publication process and make it less agonizing and more efficient? Both editors and referees could help." Raff and colleagues then make several suggestions, including having editors insist that reviewers rigorously justify additional experiments recommended by reviewers.
Science's editor-in-chief Bruce Alberts, along with deputy editors Brooks Hansen and Katrina Kellner, cited the letter by Raff and colleagues in their editorial titled Reviewing Peer Review. Read their thoughts on the peer review process, as well as the full letter by Raff and colleagues in the July 4th issue of Science.
Finally, we turn to a letter from this week's issue by Owen Hughes, senior corporate counsel at the pharmaceuticals company Pfizer. Hughes writes in response to Donald Kennedy's May 2nd editorial, Misbegotten Preemptions.
In that editorial, Kennedy, former editor-in-chief of Science and former commissioner for the Food and Drug Administration, wrote, "If you cannot sue the maker of a product, you deserve some guarantee that it's safe." Kennedy argues that the FDA cannot provide that safety guarantee, so people ought to be able to sue.
"I disagree," Hughes writes. "The regulatory process set up by Congress for the testing and approval of these products is, although imperfect, still the gold standard. It is clearly superior to regulation through ad hoc litigation. Lawsuits to penalize companies when an unknown risk results in harm to a patient do so only by undermining FDA's authority to decide which risks are significant and which are not.
Citing improved safety statistics, Hughes writes, "These statistics suggest that newer is better, that pharmaceutical and medical standards are improving, and that the FDA is raising its game. The FDA's regulatory system will never be perfect, but the greater danger to public health is that we deter innovation by trying to regulate drug development through litigation. If the FDA is to be the authority on what the label says, juries and judges cannot be given license to rewrite the label and thereby regulate the FDA."
Hughes concludes, "Any honest trial lawyer will tell you that litigation is fueled by emotion, theatrics, and opportunism. It does not produce predictable or systematic results. It certainly does not produce science, and it should not be allowed to replace scientific judgment." You can read the full letter in this week's Science.
Okay, well, thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor for Science Magazine. And that wraps up the July 25th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, with a special thanks to interns Andrea Liu and Fiona Richards. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.